The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from various medical sources. The Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Dining out well, making healthy restaurant choices. Whether for a convenience or a treat, dining out is a common and growing part of Western culture. From portion size to troublesome ingredients, there are potential downsides to regularly dining at restaurants. But that doesn't mean you need to avoid them completely. Making a few sensible adjustments in how you eat out can help you maintain a healthy diet even outside of your home. Restaurant pitfalls. Some foods at restaurants are more obviously challenging than others. Plates piled high at a buffet or baskets of greasy French fries, it's clear these aren't the wisest choices, but some diet busters are less obvious. In addition to giant portions, restaurant fare is notorious for ingredients and preparation methods. Think lots and lots of butter to drive up the calories, fat, and sodium. In fact, evidence shows that an average meal at an independent or small chain restaurant contains over 1,300 calories, almost two-thirds of what would be considered a typical 2,000-calorie diet. Industry changes. As consumers are becoming more health-conscious, the food industry is starting to make changes. As of 2018, restaurants that are part of a chain of 20 or more locations are required to list calorie information for standard menu items. These businesses must also be able to provide on request a nutritional breakdown of menu items, including the fat, sodium, sugar, cholesterol, and carbohydrate content. Many vending machines also will list the calorie content of available foods. Tips for healthy dining. To ensure your dining out experience is both enjoyable and healthy, plan ahead. If you know you'll be going to a restaurant, have lighter meals for the rest of that day. If you have already chosen a restaurant, look for menus online or in a directory so that you can plan ahead for a healthy choice rather than deciding on what sounds good on an empty stomach. Don't be afraid to ask. Don't hesitate to ask menu questions and make special requests to meet your nutritional needs. Avoid most appetizers. They are often fried and tend to be a source of hidden calories. If you do have an appetizer, order vegetables, fruit, or fish prepared without oils or butter. If a bread basket is included, ask that it be brought out with the meal rather than before so that you don't overindulge. Order deliberately. Look for a balanced meal with healthy components such as lean meats or fish, vegetables, and whole grains. Many restaurant menus denote items that are considered healthier options. Eat your sides first. Order vegetables or fruit as your sides and eat these foods first. By filling up on sides, you may eat less of your entree, which likely is higher in calories. Pay attention to your plate. Plates used at restaurants are often larger than what you'd use at home, allowing for supersized portions. Eat only as much as it would fit in an average-sized plate. And then finally, take some to go. Eat slowly, and as soon as you start to feel full, put the rest of your meal into a takeout box to eat at a different mealtime. Or ask that half your meal be boxed up before it even arrives at your table. So I'm going to list several foods, and instead of ordering these foods, with a recommendation of healthier options. So instead of ordering the following, fried, breaded, or battered food, order grilled, baked, broiled, without butter, roasted, steamed, poached. Instead of ordering French fries, onion rings, or other fried side dishes, order steamed vegetables, salad and vinaigrette dressing, and fresh fruit. Instead of Alfredo or other creamy sauces, order tomato-based or wine-based sauces. Instead of ordering creamy salad dressings, order vinegar and oil dressings. Instead of creamy soups, order tomato or other vegetable-based soups or clear broth with vegetables. Instead of mayonnaise, butter, sour cream, salt, or tartar sauce, order mustard, lemon, or lime juice, herbs and spices, pepper, and salsa. Instead of sweetened beverages, order water with a lemon slice, sparkling water, low-fat or skim milk, unsweetened tea, or coffee. Instead of ordering a mixed alcoholic drink, order a glass of wine, 3 to 5 ounces, a light beer, 12 ounces. Instead of ordering cake, pie, cheesecake, or ice cream, order sherbet or sorbet, fruit, small sugar cookie, small piece of angel food cake. The flu season. When to seek care. Your first winter illness came on fairly suddenly, with a fever and a slight sore throat. You had your flu shot, but wondered if this could be the flu. Should you seek medical care? For most older adults and those with chronic medical conditions, the best advice is to call your doctor's office and to be seen for an appointment if you've asked to come in. If you're asked to come in. Sometimes symptoms clearly suggest whether you're dealing with viral influenza or flu or another illness, such as a common cold. Symptoms of the flu can vary in atypical ways, particularly in older adults. In addition, adults 65 and older are at higher risk of complications with influenza, such as bacterial pneumonia. Taking action. Dealing with the flu involves several key steps, including, number one, getting the flu vaccine each year. This reduces the risk of flu infections and lessens the severity of illness if you do get the flu. Vaccine effectiveness varies from year to year, but it's still the single best protective measure available. Practicing good hand hygiene. Clean your hands frequently using an alcohol-based hand sanitizer or soap and water. Avoid large crowds and close contact with people who are sick. Next, contacting your doctor as soon as you suspect the flu. Your doctor can determine if you have the flu and if an antiviral drug is appropriate. Your doctor may order a simple test that detects the viruses. Antiviral drugs may be prescribed, especially if you're at a higher risk of complications. These include Tamiflu and Relenza. An antiviral drug can reduce the flu's duration and severity and the risk of complications. It's best taken within 48 hours of the start of the illness. However, studies have shown the benefits can extend beyond the 48-hour window, especially in people at high risk. Finally, being alert to complications. Contact your doctor if symptoms become more severe, improve, and then become worse, or if you have unusual symptoms such as severe sore throat, chest pain, confused thinking, dizziness, lightheadedness, or breathing difficulty. So here are the following differences between the cold and the flu. Differences in the signs and symptoms of the common cold and flu can help you differentiate between them and identify whether there has been a transition to the complication of pneumonia. So the symptom onset of a cold is more gradual. The flu is abrupt and usually between October and May. And bacterial pneumonia might occur after the flu. Fever with a cold is rare. With the flu, usually a fever of 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit or higher, lasting 3 to 4 days. Bacterial pneumonia is common and may abate, but then high fever returns. The symptom of aches, chills, and sweats with a cold or sometimes mild aches. With the flu, typical and often severe, may be milder in older adults. And pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia is common, abates after the flu, but may return. Fatigue and weakness. With a cold sometimes, but not severe. With the flu, it's common and can be severe for the first few days, then linger for several weeks. Bacterial pneumonia is common and includes shortness of breath with physical exertion. A headache. With a cold, it's rare. With the flu, it's common. And bacterial pneumonia is not typical. Stuffy nose, sneezing, sore throat. With a cold, that's common. With the flu, sore throat is possible. Nasal discharge and sneezing, uncommon. And bacterial pneumonia, no. Symptom of cough or chest discomfort. With a cold, sometimes a hacking cough. With the flu, common with a dry, persistent cough. And bacterial pneumonia, deep cough that produces yellow phlegm. Coughing or breathing can be uncomfortable. the symptom of confusion or delirium, a cold, no, the flu occasionally, and with pneumonia can be a key symptom in older adults. Finally, the symptom of nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea with a cold, a no, with the flu usually only in children, and bacterial pneumonia is a no. And a fever, just as a note, is not always present in older adults. Second opinion. Question. A family friend was recently diagnosed with emphysema, but he never smoked. Are there other causes of emphysema? Answer. Emphysema involves long-term permanent damage to the tiny clusters of air sacs, or alveoli, in the lungs, where oxygen is absorbed into the bloodstream and carbon dioxide is released to be exhaled. Alveoli tissues are normally elastic, but emphysema causes them to become stiffer. This makes it harder to move air and ultimately results in shortness of breath that gets progressively worse over time. Emphysema is one of a group of lung diseases, including chronic bronchitis, that make up chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. Tobacco smoking tops the list of emphysema risk factors. Less common risk factors include long-term exposure to dust or fumes. There also are rare inherited risk factors. One is alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which is diagnosed with a simple blood test. Normally, large amounts of the alpha-1 antitrypsin protein are made in the liver, released into the bloodstream, and distributed to the body. This protein helps protect the lungs from damage and preserves the elasticity of lung tissues. In those who have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, an abnormal protein is made and it isn't fully released by the liver into the bloodstream. Thus, the lungs lose a major protective element and become susceptible to emphysema, even in people who never smoked and had only limited exposure to other lung irritants. Smoking can greatly accelerate the damage that leads to emphysema in those with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Moreover, buildup of the abnormal alpha-1 antitrypsin protein in the liver can also lead to permanent liver damage or cirrhosis. Breathing tests or chest imaging may be used to determine the severity of emphysema due to alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Not everyone with the deficiency gets emphysema, so breathing tests and imaging can be important. Alpha-1 protease inhibitors are a recent development in the treatment of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. These inhibitors are infused products that increase alpha-1 antitrypsin levels in the bloodstream. The therapy may slow lung damage, but it can't reverse damage. It's very expensive and commonly involves weekly infusions. It's typically available only to those who meet certain criteria. A free confidential testing program is available for family members of someone with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. Details can be found on the Alpha-1 Foundation website at www.alpha1.org. From the Harvard Health Letter, virtual visits and high blood pressure. If your doctor offers a way to monitor your chronic health condition via computer, consider giving it a try. A Harvard study that was published online April 23, 2018 by the Journal of General Internal Medicine found that people who had virtual office visits over the internet were able to control their blood pressure just as well as people who had an in-person follow-up office visits, and they used fewer health care services overall. Researchers compared the health outcomes of two groups. One group included about 900 people with high blood pressure who had in-office follow-up visits. The other group included about 900 people who had virtual follow-up visits, which meant they used a website to enter blood pressure readings, track their medications and side effects, and ask questions. Their doctors determined whether to follow up by computer or phone or to schedule an in-office visit. Over the course of 6 months, blood pressures improved for people in both groups, but people in the virtual care group averaged about one fewer office visits than people in the other group, and they had fewer emergency room visits and hospitalizations overall. The authors say the results support using virtual follow-up visits for other chronic diseases. Indeed, many healthcare providers already are doing so, including one group in the study, Massachusetts General Hospitals, which uses virtual care to follow 65 different kinds of chronic disease. From the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, cornea problems, behind blurred vision. The corneas of your eyes act much like windows, which allow sunlight to illuminate in a dark room. These thin, clear structures serve a number of purposes, including protecting your eyes and starting the translation of light into vision. But if something goes wrong, blurry or impaired vision may result, a critical and complex barrier. The cornea is the clear, dome-shaped structure that serves as your eye's outermost layer. The tissues of the cornea are arranged in three main layers. The outermost layer, the epithelium, blocks the passage of foreign materials into the eye while allowing the absorption of oxygen and tears. The middle layer, the stroma, is the thickest layer of the cornea. It's made up mainly of water and collagen, a protein that gives the cornea strength and elasticity. The innermost layer of the cornea, the endothelium, keeps the cornea clear. Fluid from inside the eye normally leaks into the stroma, and the endothelium's task is to pump away excess fluid to maintain a delicate balance. For the cornea to work properly, it needs to maintain two properties. It must be transparent to allow light in, and it must have a smooth, symmetric curve so that all of the light rays come together at the same place on the retina. The cornea and the eye lens are critical to focusing your vision. When the transparency, texture, or shape of the cornea is altered, vision problems may result. Dryness and allergies. When you blink, tears are distributed across the cornea to keep the eye moist and clear. With age, tear production slows, making dry eyes a common concern. Women are especially susceptible to dry eyes after menopause. Along with a scratching sensation, dry eyes may cause stinging and burning, as well as episodes of excess tearing. Lifestyle changes, including limited screen time, taking periodic eye breaks, and protecting against wind exposure, can help prevent dryness. Mild dry eyes can often be treated with a non-prescription lubricant such as artificial tears, gels, and ointments. For persistent or more bothersome symptoms, prescription medications to stimulate tears or control inflammation are an option. In more severe cases, your doctor may recommend a procedure to temporarily plug or surgically close the tear ducts to retain moisture in the eye. Allergies also may irritate the cornea, causing redness, itching, tearing, and burning. When possible, it's beneficial to limit your exposure to allergens. If pollen is an issue for you, stay indoors when the pollen count is high. Limiting your exposure to dust may also help. Non-prescription antihistamine pills or eye drops can be used for short-term treatment of eye allergy symptoms. However, prolonged use of some drops may actually make your eye symptoms worse. If your symptoms are longer lasting, talk to your doctor about prescription options that may help. In some cases, allergy shots or immunotherapy may be the best option for providing resistance to allergens. Inflammation and infection. Inflammation of the cornea is known as keratitis. Most commonly, this is caused by a bacterial, viral, or fungal infection. Improper cleaning of contact lenses or overuse of contact lenses is a frequent source of infection. However, keratitis may also occur without an infection and is usually caused by a minor injury to the cornea. Signs and symptoms of keratitis include redness, pain, excess tears, or discharge from the eye, blurred vision, and sensitivity to light. Infection may lead to corneal ulcer. Left untreated, keratitis can lead to complete complications that may permanently damage your vision, so it is very important to have any signs and symptoms evaluated immediately. The first line of treatment for keratitis is typically with antibiotic eye drops. For non-infectious causes such as a scratch, you may not need further treatment. Although a severe scratch or other injury may require surgical treatment, such as a corneal transplant, other types of eye drops and oral medications also may be recommended to fight the source of the infection. Corneal dystrophies and ectasia. Corneal dystrophy is a condition that occurs when a part of the cornea loses its normal clarity. Dystrophies tend to develop gradually and both eyes are affected. Ectasia is another condition of the cornea in which the cornea takes on an irregular shape, astigmatism, which results in blurry vision. While these conditions don't always cause noticeable vision problems, some may lead to severe vision impairment. These include keratoconus or keratoconus. This corneal ectasia is most prevalent in teens and young adults. It occurs when the cornea thins and develops a cone-like bulge. This bulge causes light entering your eye to not focus on a single point, resulting in distorted or blurred vision. In its early stages, the vision problems of keratoconus can be corrected with glasses or soft contact lenses. As the disease progresses, rigid, gas-permeable lenses or other special lenses may be needed. Advanced disease may require surgery, with a procedure known as an intrastromal corneal ring segments, ICRS. Small synthetic arcs are inserted into your cornea with a blade or laser to flatten your cornea's cone and improve vision. A new treatment for keratoconus, collagen cross-linking, also shows promise. The procedure, which received Food and Drug Administration approval in 2016, involves using special eye drops and ultraviolet A, which is UVA, light to strengthen cross-link the tissues of the cornea. If the keratoconus is severe and doesn't respond to other treatments, another option is a corneal transplant. Fuchs dystrophy, F-U-C-H-S. With this, the cornea's endothelial cells die off more quickly than normal. This causes fluid buildup and swelling within the cornea, and as a result, the cornea thickens and vision becomes blurred. Generally, people with this dystrophy won't notice the vision problems until they're in their 50s or 60s. For mild swelling, eye drops and ointments that contain a concentrated salt solution are usually recommended to draw excess fluids out of the cornea. A corneal transplant is the only cure for the disease, but it is usually reserved for when vision is severely affected. MAP dot fingerprint dystrophy, also known as epithelial basement membrane dystrophy. This occurs when the epithelium cells form folds that may resemble map-like patches, dots, or small fingerprints. The dystrophy usually doesn't significantly affect vision, but it can cause erosion of the cornea. Signs and symptoms include blurred vision, pain in the morning that decreases during the day, sensitivity to light, and excessive tearing. These episodes may come and go over the course of several years. When symptoms flare, discomfort is often managed with lubricating eye drops and ointments. If the pain persists, procedures such as corneal scraping or laser surgery are available to remove surface irregularities on the cornea. Valuing your vision. If you're experiencing any eye pain, changes in vision, or other significant signs or symptoms, see your eye specialist for an evaluation, and don't forget regular vision screening tests. Have your eyes checked every 1 to 3 years from age 55 to 64, and every 1 to 2 years after 65. You may need to have them checked more often if you wear corrective lenses or have a family history of eye disease. Inside a corneal transplant. Corneal transplants are the most common transplants in the United States. For many cornea problems, A corneal transplant may be an effective option when other treatment options fail or when vision problems are too great. There are two types of corneal transplant procedures. The first is full-thickness penetrating keratoplasty. With this, your surgeon removes all tissue layers of the cornea and replaces them with a donor cornea. An instrument that acts similar to a cookie cutter makes a precise cut that matches the donor cornea to your own. The donor cornea is held in place with stitches that are removed at a later visit. And the next, partial thickness or endothelial keratoplasty. With this, your surgeon removes only damaged or diseased inner layers of the cornea. The surgeon then inserts healthy donor tissue through a small incision, and the tissue is initially secured to your eyeball using an air bubble. While the air bubble is present, it's important to avoid having nitrous oxide analgesia at your dentist or elsewhere. Recovery from either type of transplant surgery can be lengthy, and typically only one eye is done at a time. Most people have at least partial vision restored. Health tips: fiber, bulking up. Dietary fiber is known for improving bowel regularity. However, higher dietary fiber intake also improves cholesterol levels and reduces the risk of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and colon cancer. Recommended daily intake of fiber for people 50 and older is at least 21 grams for women and 30 grams for men. To reach that, read nutrition facts labels. Foods with 2 to 3 grams of fiber per serving are good fiber sources, but more fiber is even better. Choose breads and cereals with whole wheat or whole grain at the top as a top ingredient. Make substitutions. Swap in whole grains such as brown rice, whole grain pasta, quinoa, or barley for low-fiber options such as white rice or enriched pasta. If a baked goods recipe calls for white flour, use half whole wheat and half white instead. Add beans, black, kidney, pinto, navy, and other types of beans, and lentils are nutritional and fiber powerhouses. Use them in soups, salads, tortillas, or stir-fries. Try pastas made from beans or other types of legumes. Keep fruits, veggies, and nuts handy. Many fruits, vegetables, greens, berries, and unsalted nuts are good to great sources of fiber. Mix it in a tablespoon or two of chia seeds, ground flaxseed, or wheat germ. Add it to hot or cold cereal, a salad, or baked goods. Provides a fiber and nutritional boost. Skip the chips and try unsalted popcorn. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.